Israel's prime minister digs into his demands.
It is a valid argument that we need to toughen up, but the fact is, because we know what Hamas is, we know that the only way to bring those people home is through an agreement.
Plus, the U.S. cracks down on a Russian disinformation campaign.
There may have been other entities that were targeted, involved other U.S. companies that were tricked into running essentially content that was curated by the Kremlin.
And later, what a Trump or a Harris victory in November might mean for Ukraine. The Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit is underway, but is everyone on the same page? And tragedy for a Ugandan Olympian.
Today is Thursday, September 5th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Steve Karish, along with Lori London.
Along with the fighting, negotiations also continue in the Middle East, trying to make a deal that would bring hostages home and put an end to the hostilities in Gaza. The United States dismissed concerns that the recent criminal charges brought against Hamas's leaders in connection with the October 7th attack in Israel would complicate the talks. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
On Wednesday, Israel's military said 200 Hamas fighters in the southern Gaza city of Rafah had been killed. A day earlier, six Hamas leaders were indicted in connection to the October 7 attack in Israel by the U.S. Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
For financing and directing a decades-long campaign to murder American citizens and endanger the security of the United States.
Three of the indicted Hamas leaders, Ismail Haniyeh, Marwan Issa, and Mohammed Deif, are believed to have been killed by Israel. The three remaining include the group's top leader, Yahya Sinwar, who is key to ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire in return for a hostage release agreement. As demonstrations continue in Israel demanding a deal, the Biden administration dismissed concerns that the indictment would complicate reaching one. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We don't believe in any way the unsealing of this indictment is something that's going to enter into the calculations that Hamas may be making about whether to accept a ceasefire or not.
The U.S. charges were brought in February but unsealed Tuesday, days after Hamas had killed six hostages as Israeli forces closed in, including an American citizen, Hirsch Goldberg Polan. The charges are largely symbolic, since a U.S. arrest of Sinwar and the others is unlikely. But further U.S. action is possible. William Banks, an emeritus professor at Syracuse University College of Law, via Skype.
They can put pressure on our allies to try to secure any Hamas personnel who happen to be in an area where they can be detained, if not arrested. And I think that that threat over the longer term will continue to facilitate more peaceful efforts to come to settlements in the Middle East.
The U.S. indictment also accuses Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah of providing financial support and weapons for the October 7 attacks. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
As we've heard, the fighting, the demonstrations, and the negotiations all continue. But even as hundreds of thousands of Israelis have poured into the streets this week demanding a ceasefire deal following the execution of six hostages, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dug in on his stance that Israel must keep open-ended control of Gaza's border with Egypt. Despite his comments, though, the United States is developing a new proposal in hopes of breaking the deadlock and bringing an end to the nearly 11-month-old war. Lori spoke with Shira Efron. She's a policy advisor at the Israel Policy Forum for insights into the political standoff and public sentiment.
First of all, I mean, this has been a difficult week for Israelis and around the world, but we have to remember it's another week in 11 months that have been absolutely hell for the families of, obviously, hostages, the internally displaced people in Israel, the hundred thousands of people around here, but also, obviously, for 2 million people in Gaza, right? And there's a whole region that's tittering on the brink of a war. And I think this is an important context of what we are talking about right now, because there's the tactical question, is it Philip? Delphi, how many IDF troops stay or do they stay and when do they leave and where do they go from? And if you recall, there was also a demand on the Netzarim corridor, which bifurcates Gaza from north and between north and south. There are always the tactical questions. And then there's this big strategic question. Most of the Israeli public believes that the hostages that are in Gaza because of Hamas, the reason that they're in Gaza is Hamas brutality and barbarism and the fact that they were taken there and the fact many of them are dead now is also because of Hamas. But the Israeli public would like to believe that at least the Israeli side is doing everything in its power to bring the hostages back home, those who are alive, to bring them home to recovery, and those who are dead, to bring them to, you know, burial and mourning and allowing their families to pick up the brakes and continue with their lives. And the question of Philadelphia or Netzarim or the perimeter or when the IDF goes in is perceived as an attempt to derail the negotiations. Because, and this is something I've heard from also U.S. officials, Israel does in the closed rooms, Israel does accept the proposals. But then outside in the media, you have primarily the prime minister goes out and say, well, yes, but... And the but comes with conditions that are legitimate. You know, it is legitimate that Israel would be very concerned about smuggling of arms and dual-use materials that would let Hamas rearm. But we're not in a perfect world. And is legitimate condition, what weight do we assign to this question when it comes relatively to the lives of the hostages, to the ceasefire in this war, to the need to de-escalate tensions in the north so the Israeli IDPs can go back home, to the need to focus on what's happening in the West Bank and in Iran and calming down all the other seven fronts that Israel is fighting in, right? So this is a moral question, it's a security question, and it's a diplomatic question. And that's why the tactical question and there's the strategic question, and I'm afraid we constantly talk about the tactical questions, but not about the strategic one. The strategic one, do we end it? Do we want to bring those people home? Are we doing everything that we can as Israelis? Hamas may say no, but are we doing everything that we can as Israelis to bring them home? And according to also reports in the New York Times, but it's also very much the sentiment here in Israel that the current government of Israel is not negotiating in good faith with this big idea in mind.
Hamas is threatening to kill more hostages. I would imagine that it would hurt them too, because then they wouldn't have anything to bargain. But at the same time, they've obviously shown that they have no problem killing innocent people and flaunting it. It would seem like now more than ever, the remaining hostages that are alive are in some serious danger. But at the same time, I would imagine that it's sort of a conundrum for the government to not step up a ceasefire because they've killed hostages and because it would look as if they're placating. Is that accurate?
This is definitely a rationale that some advocate here. I have never had any expectations of Hamas. It's a cruel, barbaric terrorist organization. What they did on October 7th showed good illustration of that to Israel and the rest of the world, but it was never a legitimate actor. And that's why I don't have any expectations from Hamas. We can only control, you know, the Israeli side. Now, if Israel wants to go and penalize Hamas for what they did, yes, of course, but Hamas has been doing this to Israel for many, many years now. The issue needs to be now, how do we bring those hostages back home? And then if Israel wants to restore deterrence, don't do it on the back of the poor, who knows how many people still alive are in Gaza, right, in terms of the Israeli hostages. So it is a valid argument that we need to toughen up. But the fact is, because we know what Hamas is, we know that the only way to bring those people home is through an agreement. Sure, we can be lucky and fortunate and maybe rescue one or two, although you mentioned it yourself, Hamas said we're going to kill more hostages. So I think we have more military operations to try to rescue hostages that are now going to risk the hostages' life, which is what happened, unfortunately, last week. So, you know, this is not a perfect world. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible tragedy, and we're left with bad options all around. But if the priority of the Israeli government, and this is also a Jewish value, right, Pidyon Shvuim, if the moral thing to do is to bring whoever we can home and try to put this country back on recovery. So this is sort of the moral argument. There's a security argument because we do want to de-escalate tensions everywhere in the region and maybe prepare the IDF for the wars that it might have to engage in later on. And there's also a diplomatic argument to this. Israel is part of the international community. So we constantly hear from the Israeli government at the moment all the risks of a ceasefire now and not ending the war. And I'm asking, Can we compare these to the risks of never ending this war?
That's Lori London speaking with Shira Efron of the Israel Policy Forum.
And more news from the U.S. Attorney General's office. On Wednesday, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced charges in a scheme where Russia allegedly was trying to influence the U.S. presidential election by using misinformation, fake websites, and shell companies. VOA's Scott Walterman spoke with our national security correspondent Jeff Selden for details.
So tell us what the government did.
Well, the United States on Wednesday called out Russia, essentially putting Moscow on blast, hitting Moscow-linked companies, some of their employees, with a combination of criminal charges, sanctions, and other measures. This is all in response to what U.S. officials are describing as a malicious influence campaign that Russia has been carrying out to impact the upcoming presidential election in November, and even more generally, just to increase divisiveness and discord within U.S. society.
What are some of the things that they were alleged to be doing?
Well, there are a couple of Russian operations, two of which were targeted by the Justice Department. In one, the Justice Department and Attorney General Merrick Garland accused Russia Today, or the company that used to be known as Russia Today, which is now RT. It's a Russian-controlled media outlet, of using two of its employees and a number of fake personas and shell companies to funnel about $10 million to a company based in the United States in the state of Tennessee in order to promote and distribute English language videos and other material that would have narratives that are in propaganda favorable to the Russian government. According to the Justice Department, the company produced almost 2,000 videos since it was started in November of 2023, and it posted on TikTok, X, YouTube. They said the videos posted on YouTube got more than 16 million views alone. And they said there are concerns that this operation or this type of operation led by Russia may have been even bigger, that there may have been other entities that were targeted and involved, other U.S. companies that were tricked into running essentially content that was curated by the Kremlin. In addition, the Justice Department said it took down 32 internet domains that it said that Russia and a host of Russian companies, they said it was meant, these sites were meant to mimic news operations like the Washington Post, Fox News, legitimate news organizations. But instead of getting actual news, the people who were led to these websites through a variety of outreach attempts by these Russian companies would get straight out Russian propaganda.
So it looked like you were going to Fox News when you got there, but it wasn't really Fox News.
Instead of going to a legitimate U.S. website, it would be a fake website that pretended to be a news website. And instead of getting actual news written by actual reporters from an actual news organization, you were getting stories and other content, again, curated by Moscow, designed to promote Russian views, Russian opinions, and persuade people to adopt these views as they go to the polls in November.
That was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden speaking with Scott Walterman.
And much of that misinformation and disinformation allegedly spread by Russia is regarding the war in Ukraine, a war that Russia started by occupying parts of the country in 2014, then invading in 2022. Looking forward, Ukraine faces wildly different prospects under a potential Donald Trump or Kamala Harris presidency. But as their campaigns race to the finish line, neither candidate has laid out exactly how they plan to deal with Moscow's war on Kyiv. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports.
Ukraine's ancient capital knows well what it's like to be tossed about by the waves and whims of powerful forces. And so analysts there seem ambivalent to a possible second term for former President Donald Trump. Alexei Melnik is with the Foreign Relations and International Security Program at the Razumkov think tank.
There is a prevailing opinion that the return of Trump to the White House is not the best scenario for Ukraine, although there are also cautious opinions that everything may not be that bad.
Trump has said he will swiftly end the war, though his running mate, J.D. Vance, once said he doesn't really care about Ukraine, leaving Ukrainians unsure what to think. This makes a potential Kamala Harris presidency more of a wild card to this nation that knows Trump and President Joe Biden so well. Harris has met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and represented Biden at major transatlantic security summits. But on the trail, Harris has only briefly spotlighted Ukraine and how she differs from Trump.
He encouraged Putin to invade our allies, said Russia could, quote, do whatever the hell they want. 5 days before Russia attacked Ukraine, I met with President Zelensky to warn him about Russia's plan to invade. I helped mobilize a global response, over 50 countries, to defend against Putin's aggression. And as president, I will stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies.
Analysts say Harris is likely to follow Biden's support Ukraine playbook. And Trump's broad foreign policy pronouncements remain as vague as ever. Take Trump's promise that he will end the war in one day. Andrew Payne is a lecturer in foreign policy and security at City St. George's, University of London.
It's not entirely clear how he'll do that. The fear, of course, is that he'll do it by simply abandoning Ukraine, cutting off funds and pressuring Zelensky into negotiations at a time when Putin would enjoy all of the bargaining leverage.
But he says the battlefield has shifted with Ukrainian forces' recent decision to strike across the border and take a bite of Russian territory. While analysts widely predict that Ukraine will neither seek nor succeed in holding this land, it's a bargaining chip that will help Kyiv whoever wins. And he said Biden could also put his hand on the scale at a pivotal stage.
I wouldn't be expecting any shift in the U.S. position vis-a-vis Ukraine's military operations before November. But I would be watching between November and January, whatever the outcome, to see if there is a little bit more leash given to Kyiv.
And he notes Ukraine's leader has bolstered his relationships with European leaders and broadened his support. And so, as these two race to the end of this story, what could end up happening in Ukraine ultimately may not be up to the American president, whoever she or he is. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Flashpoint from The Voice of America. I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish in Washington.
The China-Africa Cooperation Summit is underway in Beijing. We'll find out what's happening in a few minutes.
First, though, police in Munich have exchanged fire with a man in an area near a museum on the city's Nazi-era history and the Israeli consulate. The suspect was wounded and died of his injuries. Police say there was no indication that anyone else was hurt.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveled to Haiti on Thursday for meetings with the prime minister. This as the country expanded its state of emergency to cover all of the nation's territory. The Caribbean nation has been battling violent gangs that have taken over much of the capital and is expanding into nearby regions. And in more diplomatic news, African leaders are gathering in Beijing for the 9th Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit. But will China's pivot to green technologies align with the needs of African leaders seeking investment and a more balanced trade relationship? David Doyle with Reuters has that story.
On the surface, it's all smiles and handshakes in Beijing, as African leaders gathered for a major triannual meeting. But there could be tough talks ahead, as the aims of the continent's countries come up against China's new slimmed-down priorities. Here's what to expect from the 9th Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit. Put simply, differences could occur over levels of trade and investment. China's relationship with African countries has long been associated with lending for infrastructure. But Africa's biggest two-way lender, investor, and trade partner wants to move away from funding such big-ticket projects. Instead, it wants the 50 African nations at the summit to take more of its goods, particularly around green technologies. However, African leaders are seeking a more reciprocal relationship over trade. Delegates want to hear how China plans to meet an unfulfilled pledge from the last summit in 2021 to buy $300 billion worth of goods. Echoing the aspirations of other leaders, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has told Xi Jinping that he wants to narrow his country's trade deficit with China. But analysts say Beijing's market access barriers are too strict, preventing African food exporters from selling into the 1.4 billion strong consumer market. From China's trade perspective, its top priority is to find buyers for its electric vehicles and solar panels. The United States and the European Union say those are areas in which China has overcapacity, and Western curbs on Chinese exports are looming. Green technologies also shape the way China wants to provide finance. It's already started tweaking the conditions for its loans to Africa, setting aside more for solar farms, EV plants, and 5G Wi-Fi facilities. That's while it cuts back on lending for bridges, ports, and railways. African leaders, however, will seek assurances on the progress of incomplete Chinese-funded infrastructure projects. That includes a railway designed to link East African countries. They'll also be looking for quicker financing solutions to a growing debt crisis across the continent. However, China will likely be cautious about more funding commitments. That's following debt restructuring bids in economies such as Chad, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Zambia since the 2021 summit. China may also have one eye on an ongoing geopolitical battle for influence in Africa. To avoid losing market share, the United States has started hosting African leaders. Britain, Italy, Russia, and South Korea have also held Africa summits in recent years, recognizing the potential of the region's young population and its 54 UN seats. China's outsized role in both finance and trade, however, means this summit remains the biggest show in town.
That's David Doyle of Reuters reporting.
In other African news, a tragic story coming from Kenya. Ugandan Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei has died at a Kenyan hospital where she was being treated after 80% of her body was burned in an attack by her partner.
It is a very, very, very sad day for us as a sports fraternity in Uganda to lose such a young athlete who could do a lot for the country, but also has already done a lot for the country. But even more painful to talk about is the way she died, a very gruesome death.
The country's sports minister said the 33-year-old's death is a stark reminder that authorities must do more to combat gender-based violence.
And finally today, a sad and all too familiar story from the United States. Authorities say a 14-year-old boy killed two fellow students and two teachers and wounded nine others in a shooting at a high school in Georgia, approximately 80 kilometers from Atlanta on Wednesday, just weeks after the start of the new school year. At an evening vigil for the victims, 11th grader Landon Culver described the experience.
I was listening and you could hear gunshots like just ringing out through the school, and like you're just wondering like which one of those is going to be somebody that you're like best friends with or somebody that you love. And it's like just really like a terrifying thing.
Investigators said the 14-year-old suspect, who is in custody and will be charged as an adult, was interviewed by law enforcement last year over online threats about committing a school shooting.
And that ends today's program, but there's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Steve Karish and everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori Linden.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. issues in the news explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.